You are listening to Fresh Oil, a podcast that examines the human condition while coming to terms with the purpose of life.
Hello and welcome back to Fresh Oil with Billy Dillian. This week, we're going to be looking at a pretty involved question that goes back years in my experience, and I hear it an awful lot. I hear it an awful lot today. I hear it from comedians who blame God for all the wrong in the world. I hear it from political commentary, religious commentary, social commentary, water cooler commentary. Everybody seems to have the idea that every ill in the world today is God's fault. And they blame him because he could stop it. He could do something about it. He could fix all of this. Well, if you knew the unknown book, and if you were more than a casual observer of it a couple of times a year, you'd know more about the answer to that. So, everybody says it's God's fault. The question is, what did he do about it? Is he an absentee God that only dials it in to see how we're killing each other further each day? Is he an ever-present God that enjoys in it and delights in it? I think you've got the wrong one, because there is another one, and he does delight in that. And we'll find him today. So we're going to look at some questions today. We're going to ask a series of questions that are orchestrated, if you would, by me, to take you down a logical path, to summarize and come to a conclusion. I remember whenever I got saved. Now, that's a term that you hear, and it sort of means nothing. But whenever you know what I got saved from, it means a lot to me. I'm not talking about the knee-jerk, yippee-ki-yay, Bapticostal kind of thing. Nope. I'm talking about a man that thinks and observes and looks and wondered and had the very same thing going through his own mind. If there is a God, why does he let all this stuff happen? Why doesn't he just stop it? So that's what we're going to look at today. Are you ready? Let's go deeper. So man's fall and rise has a plan, and it's not what you think it is. And it's funny that men and women and boys and girls and people of any kind of a description that sits inside the family bracket, they like to ascribe to God the horrors that humanity impose and exact upon themselves and from each other. And if you want to place blame for all the mess that we're in today, before you ascribe that blame to God, you better get all the facts. All the facts to that statement before you decide. Because blame has been assigned, all that's left is the ignorant acceptance of this error. But you really need to know all the story. And what you're about to read or listen to is that story. It's unfiltered and without bias from the unknown book. Not the opinions, not the viewpoints, not the theological ramifications of mutilated hackings of the unknown book by religious ignorance or philosophical speculations. So let's begin. I was taught that most things are the opposite of what they appear. And after 60 years, I've come to find that to be a pretty good rule. There's always exceptions to rules, but that one's pretty good. You see somebody who looks arrogant and they're jumping around and they're all this and that, and half the time it's a show. You go online, pick your poison, Facebook, Twitter, whatever. There is so much narcissism out there, and most things are the opposite. People are insecure. They're trying to do what everybody else is doing. And so the bubble for levels pretty skewered. So I was taught that most things are the opposite of what they appear. And nothing is more true than that in the thinking of man, especially when it comes to that book that's in the hotel drawer. You know, the one that you're expected to steal. Quite an irony. Men have ideas about God. They always have. Then they fabricate out of their own twisted moralizings. God couldn't be a good God if he lets that happen to little children. God couldn't be a good God if he lets war happen. God couldn't be a good God if he fill in the blank. So God's held on trial in the court of emotional appeal and ignorant logical denial. So I intend to get from the book the original plan and how it works out. Are you looking for more than the usual? Well then, let's go deeper. Inside the pages of the unknown book, there is a very detailed plan. It's the most divisive plan on earth, and it's coming through right on time. So let's get the ifs and buts out of the way. If God is God, why didn't he just make everything right to start with, dust off his hands and say, there you are, go enjoy it? Why all this trouble? God isn't very good at being God if he allows all of this to go on, according to everybody that has the issue with God. The simple question driven by moralizing humanity who think that it's God's fault that they kill each other and worse on an hourly basis. So let's come through this right this time. Now, this material is taken from a book my professor wrote, and it's an exceptional book. In fact, it's his stellar book. It's his standout book. It's called The Kingdom of Heaven and the Kingdom of God. And if you've ever been through The Prince and The City of God and Machiavelli and all of those kinds of machinations of politics exercising over man a religious control and denominating and controlling the education of that process, the skewering begins. And you get all of the moralizing that man will beat their swords into plowshares, and whenever man learned that this and this, and after this war will it be the war to end all wars, and on it goes. So we need to come through this time right. And my professor wrote this book, and it was an exceptional book, and I'm using the outline of to some degree of what he wrote, and I hope you enjoy it. I hope you listen to it. I hope you understand it. And it comes through as a series of questions. I'm asking you, the listener. So here's the first question. And it's the right place to start. Because everything follows from this question. Question number one. Why did God make the heaven and the earth? Now, the man that says he doesn't believe in God raises his hand and says, excuse me, it's time to leave. And I say, okay. We all believe in something. And by professing to not believe in one, we make a statement that there has to be one because we've chosen to acknowledge that we don't want to recognize one. And you can find that over in Romans chapter 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5. And I'll talk about that later. So why did God make the heaven and the earth? In the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis, in chapter 1, verse 1, the book says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Now, according to this unknown book, he made these heavens and earths to be inhabited. And you can find this by looking in the Old Testament, the book of Isaiah, chapter 45, and verse 18. And in the New Testament, in the second book of Peter, chapter 2, and verse 13, you can see a companion passage of Scripture that states that. He made them to be inhabited. And so, inhabited with who and with what? Why, it would appear us, of course. So if God made them, this is the second question, if God made them, and if he, God, is perfect, why didn't he make his creation perfect? Now, this is the conversation I've tried to have myself many times with people, taking them down through these points, because you're extracting the emotion and you're looking for a spiritual direction to the question. It's God's fault, and what's he going to do about it? If God made them and he's perfect, why didn't he make his creation perfect? And the answer is, the pages of the unknown book reveal that he did make them perfect. But, and because, mankind as man handled the unknown book into their own designs, they have missed much. In Genesis 1, verse 1, that was the original design and execution of the creation. But in Genesis 1, verse 3 through verse 28, we are dealing with a recreation of the original one because something happened. Note, even the main protagonist that we're going to bump into in this question-response narrative that I've set up today, and there is a main protagonist, and he's way past the caricature that he's presented as. He is the most sophisticated, suave, politically tuned in, emotional empath ever designed and put around man. And you're going to see him. So even the main protagonist was created perfect before he fell, and lots of things changed for him. He has a name. For before Satan became a serpent, a devil and more, he was a cherub. And that was his original position. And if you want to see, if you want to read about the absolute fall of something perfect, you go to the Old Testament, you go to the book of Ezekiel, you look at chapter 28, and begin in verse 14, 15, and read down. But we don't want to get ahead of things here. We'll go over what a cherub is, not the greeting card industry's version of one, because they certainly have that chubby little guy and his cute blonde hair and his arrow pinging everybody with something called the love bug. And February 14th, we all jump in on that. So the third question, if God made them all perfect, what changed? Why aren't they all still perfect now? Isn't this what John Lennon's aiming for? Imagine there's no this, imagine there's no that. A nihilistic disappearing of everything. We don't exist, we aren't here. Everybody gets along, but you can't get along because you're not here, because there isn't anything to be here with. Oh well. If God made them all perfect, what changed? Why aren't they all still perfect now? And the answer, of course, and in course, is something happened that caused a change in the physical creation and conditions of that creation, the universe. Between Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and Genesis chapter 1, verse 3. And what you get to read, and what you get to see unfold in the rest of that book, is what took place inside those two verses. And something else happened that changed the spiritual condition of the creation. Man and woman, between Genesis 2:7 and Genesis 3:13. So two things changed, the physical creation and the spiritual created beings that were put on it, man and woman. So they changed, and that's what we're going to look at. The fourth question is, if God is perfect, as described in the unknown book, and God loves perfection, why didn't he prevent this something from happening to both creations? So it seems like a pretty sensible process of questioning going along. I know you don't believe in God. I know you have made up your mind. God couldn't be a good God if he let all this happen. But if you'll just listen, we'll continue down this path and we'll come to some conclusions that you've already arrived at and more. So something happened to the physical and the spiritual creation before we get out of chapter 3 of the unknown book. Which brings us to the fourth question. If God's perfect, as described in the unknown book, God doesn't, and he loves us, why didn't he prevent this something from happening in both creations? And the answer is, although the material creation was perfect before the events that took place, as I've just described, the man that he put on the creation was not. He was only sinless. Oh, there's the word. There's the word. Sin. That's the word. That is the word that drives humanity nuts. And we're talking about that in a minute. I'm not part of the normal long hair pants and Billy Graham redneckdom preaching. I would like to think I've thought this thing out a little bit over the last 40 years. And I'm trying to bring something here that's fresh oil for you, that'll make you think, that might even make you steal a copy of the Bible out of some hotel room you're in at night and look this up and follow along this logical sequence of thinking. So here's the fifth question that you're probably asking about right now. What on earth are you talking about here? Answer. If the Creator God is perfect, no being is perfect until he is completely like his Creator. And some people would harp in right now, well, we are like him. Look at, he must be like us, because look at the way we are now. But there's been a change from the original design. It's called the fall. It's this word sin. So Adam was originally made in God's image in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. 27 and 28. But his sinlessness, his state, and there's two things in life that you have to understand about spirituality. There is your standing and your state. Now, my standing before the book and the author of the book is, I've been redeemed. The transaction, all of the legal requirements have been met, and I have an assurance that I've met the terms, and I have the guarantee that my redemption is complete. The problem and the confusion for most other people is that the life I live is, what kind of redemption do I live by? In other words, what kind of a person am I? Am I a moral person? Am I an immoral person? Am I a just person? Am I an unjust person? So on and so forth. So my standing before God is, I'm legally free. I'm fixed. I've been redeemed. My day-to-day actions either verify that or contradict that. And that's the problem for most people. Because don't we have all of the Jimmy Swaggards and all of those kinds of guys making it worse and hard for everybody? So Adam, when he's in this garden, after the recreation of Genesis 1:3 and so on, he's under a situation where there is a God who's going to allow some things, to find out some things. So let's proceed. So, why on earth are we talking about here? And what do I mean anyway? Well, you may reply, what do you mean tested? And what really is this sin thing anyway? And why is it so big in the unknown book? Why did God allow this sin to be there anyway? Why did he put all this stuff in our path? Why didn't God just do it right and not have this thing going on where all of this humanity is in this turmoil and this murderous beauty, the savage garden, as it was called by somebody recently? Well, that's a lot of questions, and we'll answer them, but we want to slow it down a little bit and go one at a time. But know this, in the unknown book, sin is an act, a nature, a thought, or word against the Creator, God. It is any wrong thing done, spoken, or thought contrary to the absolute authority of God concerning it. And you go, well, I don't believe that. I don't believe God's just. I don't believe God has the authority to judge me. I know you think that. You may be a good upstanding citizen, pay your bills, take care of your family, meet all of your obligations. But you're not dealing with me and the standards that we make. We're dealing with God. So in the Old Testament, in the book of Psalms, chapter 51, verse 4, we find out about this God. In the New Testament, in the first book of John, chapter 5, and verse 17, we find out about this act of sin. Now, everybody's get the idea that, you know, sin is stealing, and sin is this, and sin is lying, and sin is theft, and sin is all of murder and rape, and all of the nut job mentality that's going on in the world today. Those are reflections of the conduct of people, act, nature, thought, or word, violate their Creator and His original intent. And that has to be dealt with. So let's look at it. Let's ask the sixth question. If God is this perfect God that He claims He is, wouldn't He know the result of this test before He let it take place? So here we have a God that recreated the world, and He's put a man in it, and He's put a woman in it, and He's given them some instructions about how to conduct themselves in this location that they find themselves in, this earth. And He tells them, don't do this. Don't eat of this certain tree. And so here's the test. Will they be obedient and do what they're told? Or will they be disobedient and eat of the fruit? Simple. Yes, God's this perfect, and He did know the result of the test before He let it take place. God knew Adam would fall, fail the test, and lose this sinlessness, knowing this God still gave him freedom of a will and of a choice, so he could fall or resist and not fall. Maybe you know the story. Maybe you're familiar with the problem. There is a third member of this little arrangement that shows up, and we're going to meet him soon. So here's the question. Here's the one you want. Then God is directly responsible and to blame for what took place in this creation. If He allowed it, knowing He could fall, knowing He would, letting Adam and Eve go ahead and falling. So God's responsible. Most Christians go, oh, no, 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 no. God isn't responsible. This is man, da-da-da-da-da. If God is God, and He knew what He knew, and He didn't stop it, and He let him fall, and He allowed all that we've got going on our planet today, and all of the environmental abuse, humanity, war, lying, deception, manipulation, political chicanery, the absolute denial of the good, overshadowed by this conduct that is contrary to what the initial, original creation of man was meant to be. You're right. God's directly responsible, and we're going to say He's to blame. He could have stopped it. Now here's a sidebar. Now's not the time to shirk the truth of this. The unknown book does not shirk it. That is the domain of men who think they know what God meant to do or say. And they correct His words to prove themselves right in their moralizings. So we need to get this right before we go further, for only the unknown book can reveal it all. And it will, and it does. Yes, the Creator God Almighty could have prevented Adam and Eve's sin and the resulting conditions they created for the rest of us. But God did not prevent them. If you look at the Old Testament, the book of Lamentations, chapter 3, verse 38, you'll see. And in a counterpart in the New Testament, or in the Old Testament, in the book of Job, chapter 2 and verse 10, God could have prevented it, but he didn't. So you ask me, then God is responsible for all the ills in the world that man is burdened under? And my answer is, no. In the New Testament, in the book of James, in chapter 1, verse 13 through 15, God does not tempt any man, neither can he be tempted. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lusts and enticed. What are you talking about? Because God let something happen, and because God did not prohibit it from happening, is evidence of the free will of the creation he made. And there is a most critical reason for that, and we'll come to it in a minute. So you ask, if God didn't tempt Adam, who did? And the answer to that was his wife, Eve. In the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis, in chapter 3, verses 4, 5, and 6, she was the one that tempted her husband to disobey what God clearly told them not to do. And in the New Testament, in the first book of Timothy, chapter 2, verses 12, 13, and 14, we see it even further explained. Okay, well, if Eve tempted Adam, who tempted Eve? A very unusual entity called the serpent. In the New Testament, in the book of 2 Corinthians, chapter 11, verses 1, 2, and 3, we read of this individual. So why don't you read the verses online for us? Well, in good marketing, it's called opt-in. If this is something that you're really curious about, you'll go find an authorized version, and you'll begin looking up these references, because this is what we really get down to the nub of navigating the human condition and coming to terms with the purpose of life. But if it's not for you, then it's not something you're going to pursue. So we see it was the serpent. So here's the 11th question. Who tempted the serpent? Oh, who tempted the serpent? Before the serpent was a serpent, he was something else. He was created a cherubim. Now, a cherubim, if you want to get an example of that, is found in Ezekiel in the first four or five chapters, where you'll see that in the narrative, God's throne is being carried along by these cherubim. And they have eyes within and without, and their description is clearly portrayed. They have the appearance of a man. That's important. And this cherubim was called the anointed cherub that covereth. He was over the top of this throne of God. And in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 28, verses 12 through 17, this cherub violated God's holiness by a self-determining act of sin, a thought, a consideration, conduct, contrary to the nature of the person, God, who created him. And in the book of Isaiah, chapter 14, verses 12 through 15, we read more of this cherub that fell and became a serpent. And in this account in Isaiah, he violated God's authority by an act of rebellion. And the thing to notice in that passage is how many times the word "I will" shows up. So there was a self-determination, there was an act of choice, even for the serpent. He could or he could not. And I know you're going back to your original position. What's the point of all this? Where's this going? Why didn't God just stop anything from happening? Make us all love him? Now, that is starting to head in the direction where we're going to be going to next. So the fallen human condition sets in whenever this little test takes place in the garden. And this is the usual retort that comes from man. If God is eternal, sinless, the Creator, all-knowing, he must know the end from the beginning. If he could have prevented even the temptation and enticement of this Lucifer, he would have known, and he should have done it, and he should have stopped it, because look at all of the things that happened from it. This is true. But here's the thing. You're ignorant of the unknown book. You haven't read from Genesis 1:1 to Revelation and the last words, "Even so come, Lord Jesus." You haven't read that. You haven't read it annually for the best part of your life. You haven't dedicated or sought out the truth of these things. Or maybe you have pursued it, lost your way. Maybe you've been to a seminary even and found out that it was an annoying waste of time. Or you lost your faith. God the Creator lets a lot of things fall in the design he has initiated while working out his original plan. And you find this in the New Testament, the book of Romans, chapter 11, verse 11 through 32. Well worth the moments it takes to read. So here's another question, the 12th one. Then God is not only responsible for man's sin, but the sins of the serpent as well, since he allowed both to take place. Therefore, the Creator's to blame. Here come the marching bands. Here come the natural viewpoint of humanity. There you are. We've got it locked in. It's his fault. We're free of guilt. He has to fix us. We can live whatever way we want. We're entitled to our fallen nature because it's not our fault. And then somewhere in along here, we get the usual statement, there's no God. If there was a God, none of this would be allowed to happen. God wouldn't let babies be beaten or fried, or he wouldn't let war take place. He wouldn't let animals suffer. He wouldn't let all of these wicked people go away and do what they do. What's the purpose of all of this? Man, at his best states, altogether vanity. Did I say that our site was called Fresh Oil? We would bring you something fresh? This is not an acerbic podcast designed to make little of anybody. It's a quite serious approach to a very serious condition, the human condition, and the purpose of life. Because God has allowed imperfection into his creation and takes responsibility for it, you say he's not a perfect God. The serpent's free. The man and the woman's free. They chose. So you say man's free and clear of his enticement because they were created by God who did this to them, so it's God's fault. And thus the title of a podcast. And my answer, what did he do about it? So let's look and see now. What would happen to this creation and this allowed fall should it all be remedied by the Creator? Should God make all things right, what then? Right back to the very first two people in the garden. If God fixed it all and sorted out a way that everything could be put in its place and fixed, what then? If God made everything right, would that resolve the issue? In the New Testament, in the book of Romans, in chapter 3, verses 4 through 6, we get our answer. When the unknown book reveals that the Creator undid what evil he allowed to enter into the physical and spiritual creation, will you then recognize that he is perfect. Here is the story of how that was accomplished, completed, atoned for, and eternally settled. First of all, this God, our Creator, our Maker, he became flesh and dwelt among us. He came down to this fallen earth and this fallen mankind in the body of a man. Holy a man and holy the Creator. Read John chapter 1 for corroborating evidence of Genesis chapter 1. The Creator bore man's guilt for the disobedience by choice to listen to his wife, who listened to a serpent, who extolled his own virtue and rebelled against his Maker Creator by his own act of volition of free will that he was given. And God bore the guilt of all of them. The book of 2 Corinthians chapter 5 verse 21. He, God, is said to have become the personification of all sin. And you can read that in the New Testament, the book of Galatians, chapter 3, verse 13. So much so that he resembled a serpent. The New Testament, the book of John, chapter 3, verse 14. And every Easter, whenever the world gets a bit of a religious tizzy going, and they remember the resurrection and all of those kinds of things, and Western culture and society reviews its relationships to Christianity as an entity, not an experience. It ends with these words, "It is finished." Our God, our Maker, the Creator, allowed the fall of the serpent, the man and the woman, and then immediately went about the design of providing a way to fix it all by becoming and bearing the sin of them all. The restoration is completed, but not yet fully realized. And that bothers you. That bothers a lot of people. Because it wasn't instantaneous. Let's fix it. Wave the magic wand. But the restoration has been completed as a victory. As an actuality. That's future tense. All the events that will draw everything to occlusion are playing out. And only through reading the unknown book can you find what is yet to come. If you like to cheat, and most of us do, then read the last three chapters of the last book, The Revelation of Jesus Christ. Not for the shock value of all of the things that are said to take place there. In chapter 1 of Genesis, there's a tree they're told to leave alone. They disobey. There's another tree there. And in the last book, in the book of Revelation, that tree's sitting there again. Only this time, you're given access to it. So, if he, God, then has reconciled all the fallen things he's allowed to become imperfect, and he paid a price for that. Oh, did mankind and the serpent who wanted him beaten and defeated so that he could stay as the God of this world, so that he could still control man because they became his dominion whenever they disobeyed God. So if he, God, has reconciled all these fallen things, he's clear of any blame. And we find that in the New Testament in the book of Romans, chapter 9, verse 20. The usual and often repeated response about right now in this conversation. I don't believe all that nonsense. You've fabricated a straw man and you've got a logical progression going on here that could be torn down by any decent intellectual. A decent intellectual will have read the unknown book and considered it wisely. They're scarcer than hen's teeth. But some people do respond, and they go looking for the redemption and the conditions that are offered as a result of God taking the blame upon himself and redeeming his creation and his created and worked the path back to where perfection, sinlessness, after testing, can be achieved. Now here's the part most people pay a whole lot of attention to in the liberal theologians of the world from the pulpits of the do-gooders. They say, God is perfect, and love is one of the qualities he embodies. And this is true. In the book of 1 John in the New Testament, chapter 4, verse 16, and verse 8, we see that God is love. He personifies love. And for this love to be perfect and a perfect love, there has to be two parties. One person loving someone else who has no time for you isn't love. That's torture. And who didn't go through that in their teenage years? I think you called it a crush. And one person loving themselves isn't real love, is it? Narcissist couldn't get his face out of the puddle. So God created this second party, Adam, the man, to provide and respond to this essence that God is. God is love. And we find this in the New Testament, the book of Hebrews, chapter 2 and verse 6. Now, if the man does not have free will to return this love that his creator and designer embodies and he has placed within him, then he is no more than an automaton and he has no free choice in the matter, either to love or to not to love his creator. An automaton can return a form of love. God could have said, okay, you're all going to love me. It's all going to be perfect. You're not going to know anything different. And this is the only way it's going to be. You're not going to be cognizant. You're not going to be self-determining or aware. You're just going to love me and it's all going to be perfect. And hello, Stepford Wives. The man Adam must have the choice, as must his wife. And what you find in Adam and Eve is indicative of what follows. All of their children have a choice. The billions of us that are now here, the multiplied millions of us, have a choice. And if you choose the serpent, you come under the dominion and control of the God of this world at this minute. He's in charge. And you can find that in the second book of Corinthians in the New Testament, chapter 4 and verse 4. Or you can choose God. You know, the one that everybody blames that it's his fault because he allowed it to happen. And in the Old Testament, in the book of 1 Kings, chapter 18, verse 21, you can see that there is always a choice. So God allows this being, the cherub, to appear and tempt mankind, Adam and Eve, so that they, Adam and Eve, can freely choose God as an object of love through obedience to him, or they can choose the serpent through obedience to him. What do they do? Well, Adam chooses his wife as the object of his love, and his wife chooses knowledge as the object of her love. And the man falls, and God redeems the man by bearing the entire blame for man and the cherub. And we find this in the New Testament, the book of Romans, chapter 5, verse 6 through 19. God does this by bearing sin as a man, holy man and holy God, dying on the cross as a man. Not some good example, not the Khalil Gibran, not the ultimate socialist, not the ultimate humanitarian, not the ultimate poet. God with a design of living a life that man didn't, and then being beaten and unmercifully crucified by the creation to redeem them. Puts a new twist on the account. In the Old Testament, in the book of Isaiah, read chapter 53. In the New Testament, in the book of Romans, chapter 10, verse 2, read and learn. God, now having absolved himself of all guilt or blame, it is now possible for the man to be confirmed sinless forever. Because now you have a choice again. When Adam and Eve fell, you were choiceless. We were subject to what Adam and Eve did. We were subject to what they introduced, that fallen nature, that conduct, that condition of life, out of step with the Maker, the Creator, with no way back until the Creator became sin for us and redeemed us himself, bore all the blame. God has already done more than is required or all that is possible, all that could be asked. He has done so because he loves us. God has delivered the way back to him. It's perfection. In the New Testament, in the book of John, chapter 1, verse 10 through 12, you can read this. In the New Testament, the book of John, chapter 3, verse 16, we read the Savior citing and quoting the verse of a century. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. In concluding this, I remind you of something. You have to choose. It's the only option you've really got left. You choose him, or you choose the fallen cherub, Lucifer, that old serpent, the dragon. I have chosen the Son of God. Who will you choose? It's an either-or decision. By default, to not choose God is to automatically choose the serpent. There is no neither, because it asks a moral decision of you to do so. Over all the years, over all the time, over all the events, over all the humanity and the people I've talked to, one of the reasons that drove me to this approach is that the only people that go to church are the people that go to church. The great so-called unwashed that don't hear this information are resting up after having worked 6 days a week and are tired, juggling family and bills and payments and the debt culture that we live in today. So how do you talk to them? How do you find them? Well, here on Fresh Oil, it's unfiltered commentary, and this is as unfiltered as you can get. This is as honest as I can be. This is an accounting of things that you may not have considered, that you may have out of hand just accepted what someone told you, and I hope to have prompted you to consider more. You want to navigate the human condition? You want to come to terms with the purpose of life? You can't do it without that unknown book. Of course, I'm talking about the Bible. But whenever you use familiar words and you use familiar approaches, people turn you off before they even heard what you said. And by my approach, it's to try and get you to consider, you think you know what's in that book, but do you? Well, you can save this information as a PDF by clicking at the bottom of the text that's on the website, or of course you can download the podcast if you so choose. This is heavy as I'll ever be. This is as heavy as I'll ever put on you. But you need to hear it. We're going to interview somebody next week. A man called Michael Delaney. He makes guitars. You say, what a switch that is, Billy. Yeah, it is, kind of, isn't it? We have to take the back up to the levity factor and bring it into something and talk about human beings. We make things. We create things. We're a reflection of the design and the designer. So come back next week, because we're going to go deeper with Michael Delaney.
You've been listening to Fresh Oil with Billy Delaney. Thanks for pressing play.